from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Michael Krasny. Coming up this hour, the forces of gentrification may seem like a relatively recent trend, but it actually has a long history in the United States. We'll delve into that history with WNYC senior editor Matthew Sherman. His new book, Newcomers, Gentrification and Its Discontents, examines our nation's struggle with gentrification from the 1950s to today in New York, Chicago, and right here in the Bay Area.
If you want to revive a city, who do you revive it for? Who is gentrification for? It should be for the people who are living there in these communities. What's the point of reviving a community if the people who have been living there for a long time do not benefit from it?
Coming up right after the news. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Michael Krasny. Well, the battle over gentrification heated up in San Francisco with the rise of the tech economy, many would say. But in his new book, Newcomers, author Matthew Sherman examines historical struggles over gentrification here in San Francisco, but also in New York and Chicago from the 1950s up to today. He argues that if we hadn't abandoned certain federal policies in the 1970s, we could have limited some of the most stark displacements we see today as a result of gentrification. His research, of course, included San Francisco's Mission District, which is sort of the epicenter of San Francisco's gentrification battle. We'll get into that with our guest, who I should also mention is a senior editor at WNYC Public Radio, Matthew Sherman. Welcome to Forum.
Thanks so much for having me, Scott.
Let me begin where the book begins, which is in Brooklyn in the 1950s. Why did you choose that starting point?
It was in Brooklyn in the late 1950s when I really saw, when you look at some of the newspapers from that area and talk to some of the people who lived there at the time, that there was an increasing awareness, self-consciousness about the benefits of living in the city. These were young professionals. They called themselves young marrieds. A lot of them were journalists, like you and me, Scott, social workers, teachers, some Wall Street lawyers. And instead of moving to the suburbs, as many of their peers did in the upper middle income bracket, they moved back to the city, or they stayed in the city after college, and they often bought homes and fixed them up. And they really saw virtue in doing that. They wanted to reject the conformity of the suburbs. They also wanted to reject what was going on there in the city at the time, urban renewal, which you know as well in the San Francisco area took place in places like the Western Addition. And they really saw, they didn't call it gentrification at the time, but they saw renovating old homes and instilling a sense of community, supporting local businesses. Those are all good ways to revive the city in a sort of more natural, organic way.
And what was it about Brooklyn Heights, which is where the book begins, as opposed to, say, the Lower East Side or some other place in Manhattan?
Well, I became aware in doing my research that it was at that time that there was a really cohesive community movement that at first formed to reject a proposed urban renewal project at the time called Cadman Plaza. And they were then, it was probably earlier than that type of activity that you might have seen elsewhere in the city. There are some places like Greenwich Village, which arguably even started earlier, or Beacon Hill in Boston. But it was around this time that that a lot of the discourse you saw sort of embrace the city as an ideal community in which to live in.
You said that those early pioneers, I guess you could call them, in places like Brooklyn Heights, they didn't call it, or no one really called it, gentrification. So where does that word come from, and how do you define it?
It came from an introduction to a book in the 1960s, an introduction written by a sociologist, Ruth Glass. And it was really about London, actually. She noticed that the so-called gentry were moving into working class areas in London. And the way I define it, the way people define it all sorts of different ways, but I think the simplest way of looking at it is the process by which a neighborhood turns from being low income to being upper income, or just below the median for the entire area, metropolitan area, to just above it.
And are there commonalities? I'm sure there are differences, but are commonalities between, say, you know, Beacon Hill or Brooklyn Heights and the Mission District? I mean, what are some of the the attributes that those places have that are similar?
Well, gentrification sort of tended to start out in places that were in central cities, so that these areas were generally cheap for the young marrieds or pioneers or early gentrifiers, let's call them, to move in. Often home ownership was the way it started. Renovate those places. These were close to transit lines, so people didn't necessarily need a car to get places. It was an early embrace of things like mass transit. There was also generally nice architecture, old architecture, and that was, again, sort of expressed a certain authenticity that these early gentrifiers wanted to embrace and encourage. Along with the early gentrification movement came the earliest historic districts. Historic preservation was a big part of it. So those all were fairly common attributes of these early neighborhoods that first saw gentrification. But, you know, what's been interesting is that as more and more of these cities like New York and the really successful cities, New York, San Francisco, as these older architecturally distinctive neighborhoods become gentrified, you do see the concentric rings of gentrification moving further and further out. And now places that are not necessarily architecturally distinctive or even all that close to transit sometimes, seeing a real influx of highly educated upper middle income people.
You mentioned the appreciation for some of the old architecture. To what extent what role do artists play in this whole story?
Well, you often see them in what might be called the first wave of gentrification, especially in former industrial areas, in south of Market area, for example, in San Francisco, and also the northern part of the Mission certainly saw that as well. Dumbo in Soho in New York, River North in Chicago. These were attractive places. They were in part because of their architecture. It was a little bit different than, let's say, the sort of the bourgeois aspect that you might see in Brooklyn Heights or DuBose Triangle. Actually was maybe the earliest part of San Francisco to have gentrified. These were industrial areas. They were raw, high-ceilinged, large, great places for artists to live and do their work at the same time. So that was part of the attraction for early artists. And then, of course, as time goes on, more and more artists move there. Other people, let's say they work for nonprofits or they're teachers or they're somehow, you know, iconoclastic in their own sort of way, even though they might not be artists, then they start to move in and that sort of thing. And they start to turn a formerly industrial area into a more residential area. So you see that happening a lot of places around the country as well. And, you know, one of the chapters of my book actually looks at Dumbo in particular, which is a part of Brooklyn, and also with very large loft spaces. And there it's interesting because a large portion of Dumbo, the name stands for Down Under the Manhattan Bridge Overpass, D-U-M-B-O. And of course, it has that wink, wink sense of humor that you get these days in real estate circles. There was just one man, David Willentis, who owned a large portion of this area. He just sort of lucked out, made a big bet, and he actually sort of artificially curated this movement of trying to bring in the artists at first, make the neighborhood have a certain creative cachet, and then slowly, after he won zoning approval, converted these loft spaces to condominiums, very high-priced condominiums and office spaces. So there you see this sort of that sort of otherwise organic process of artists moving in the first wave of gentrification. You see a real estate person really taking advantage of that and exploiting it.
Well, and you mentioned that some of those spaces that artists moved into were sort of manufacturing or industrial spaces. And does that speak to sort of a transition in the economy also? Because if you look at a place like San Francisco, I mean, there's not nearly as much manufacturing, heavy manufacturing at least, that went on, say, in the 50s and 60s.
Absolutely. Certainly, I would say there was a bit of a chicken and egg issue there as to whether or not the industrial companies left before the artists and other residential inhabitants moved in, but definitely you can prove actually that manufacturing companies were moving out. In part, this is because of mechanization. Machines could do the work that humans could do, exporting a lot of our labor, a lot of our industry to non-union southern states here in the United States or overseas. And then as more and more industry left these neighborhoods, the pressure to rezone them to residential began to build more and more as well. So there is a bit of a chicken and egg there, but definitely we saw a transition from the manufacturing economy to what I call the creative economy or the information economy, in which office jobs became much more important. And this too has a lot to do with gentrification, because the people who tended to be in these creative jobs had a very different mindset from the people who tended to be in manufacturing jobs. There was a housing expert in New York City a long time ago named Roger Starr. He said the professional has infinite social distance from the working class person. He does not see himself in competition with that person. He does not worry about living side by side with that person. It's not like somehow affronting his pride, or he's not worried about what his relatives think because he lives in a working class neighborhood. Whereas working class ethnic whites wanted to move out of the city, he says, in part to distance themselves, to create a physical distance from really people of color who were moving into the cities at that time.
Talking to Matthew Sherman, he is senior editor at WNYC Public Radio in New York, and he's the author of Newcomers, Gentrification and Its Discontents. He will, by the way, be in the Bay Area later in the week. He's going to be at Alley Cat Books in San Francisco on Friday at 7 o'clock and at the Oakland Public Library on Saturday, the 7th of December at 1 o'clock. And we'd love to hear from you. I'm going to open up the phone lines a little early. I'd love to hear from you how gentrification has affected your life. Have you been displaced by it, or maybe played a part in gentrifying a neighborhood? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, it's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. And Matthew, in the foreword of your book, sort of paraphrasing here, but it says, gentrification is all around us. It's in the clothes we wear, the food we eat, the walls of our homes, and the decision to bike, take the subway, or drive to work. Gentrification is arguably in every breath we take. What are you getting at there?
I'm getting at just how ubiquitous this phenomenon has become. I get these Google alerts whenever the word gentrification appears in a newspaper article or online somewhere. And I get them from the most strange places, South Carolina, North Carolina. I think there was one from Asia today that I got. It's really popping up everywhere. It's true, I should say, that there still are plenty of cities that are not experiencing gentrification themselves. But I think that I would hazard to guess that most urban people, especially those who work in the professions, who are frankly likely to read my book, will have heard about it in some sort of way. My aunt in Rochester, New York, for example, the former home of Kodak, thousands of jobs lost there. She was even saying that even there, they're experiencing gentrification. And my point is really in that introduction to suggest to people to convince people to look at themselves in that spectrum of gentrification and to recognize what, if anything, they might have done either to encourage it or maybe to have been the victim of gentrification. I think we tend to think of ourselves overwhelmingly as victims of gentrification, but I think a lot of times we're blind to playing a role in encouraging it as well.
We I have lived and worked in the Mission District, which you have several chapters in the book dedicated to the Mission. And, you know, I've seen, you know, from, say, the dot-com boom and bust to today, several waves of gentrification. How would you describe that evolution in the neighborhood? And maybe even talk about BART and how the decision to have two BART stations instead of one played a role in what the Mission became.
Yeah, it's a good question. I do go back a long way, and in part to show people how certain geographic considerations and decisions made very early on play a role in today's gentrification, often in the most unintentional and unexpected ways. One was the BART. When the state legislature set up this commission to create this mass transit system called the BART, they took, in some ways, the easiest route from downtown San Francisco south to South San Francisco. And, you know, because of all the hills that you have in your city, the Mission was a very flat area, and it would be obvious to go right down Mission Street there. Originally, they had sketched out just one BART station in the Mission, which was at 22nd Street. But then at that time, they really thought that the BART was going to go along Geary Street and across the Golden Gate Bridge to Marin County. Of course, the Golden Gate Commission itself, the Golden Gate Authority, Golden Gate Bridge Authority,
District.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Excuse me, what was that?
The Bridge District, I think it was.
The Bridge District, okay, thank you. Rejected that idea. You may well know about it. It seemed like it wasn't really for engineering considerations, but they said it was for engineering considerations. So once Marin County was out, then
and let me just stop you there, because I think there was – I always had the impression that Marin County didn't want it because they didn't want, you know, it bringing people of color to Marin, which is predominantly white. But you're saying, or the book says, that it was actually the Bridge District was worried about losing revenue from people going over the bridge back and forth.
That's right, and that's based on a report from the time that was commissioned by the BART, basically. That was their explanation that they gave, that it was really had to do with the Bridge District. I'm sure Marin County may have had played some sort of role, but it was the Bridge District that basically said, we're not going to let you go over, bring that train over our bridge.
Probably regret that now, I would think.
Well, a lot of people do, yes. And so once that went out, Geary Street, the Geary Street extension went out because BART didn't see any point in going out in that direction in San Francisco. Although now I understand that they're reconsidering that and thinking about putting an extension right there.
Yeah.
And so once San Francisco lost all the stops along Geary Street, then they added an extra one in the Mission. They reconfigured it somewhat, so it's now at 16th Street and 24th Street.
Well, and that had a huge impact, as Mission Street was dug up for a very long time, and it put a lot of those small businesses out of business, I would think. That's my recollection anyway.
Well, there was certainly disruption. There was a tunnel boring machine that dug the BART tunnel for most of the way, but it's true that there was a lot of excavation right around those stations that undoubtedly was very disturbing for businesses and residences in the area. What's interesting is that, so now when you go to the Mission, you ask people, well, why is Mission gentrifying? There are lots of different reasons. But one reason is that, heck, you're really, most of the Mission is within a 10-minute walk of a BART station, and BART is a mighty quick way to get around the region.
Talk about the role of one of the neighborhood activists, Rene Yanez, who did a lot to preserve the cultural heritage in the Mission.
That's right. Yes, Rene was a Chicano artist, Mexican-American artist. He came to the Bay Area in the late 60s. He loved art. He loved making community. Was a big value of his. And so he co-founded the Galleria de la Raza in the Mission and became eventually its artistic director. He also got a position for the city where he was able to commission street murals. And he came up with this idea to have people paint on the sides of businesses along the, eventually eventually the murals would spread to the alleyways. That actually wasn't part of his original conception. But he sort of really inspired the whole mural movement that took root in the in the Mission District. And, you know, one of the interesting things is that he, at the same time of doing all this, I think that when you create one of the sad aspects, tragic comic aspects of gentrification is that as you try to create community for whatever group you represent, whatever neighborhood you're in, whether it's rich or poor, middle, Latino or black or white, you often make that neighborhood more attractive to outsiders coming in. And I think arguably that is one of the sad things that happened to the Mission District. And so the murals became sort of an entree, a way that people from outside the Mission got to know the Mission.
Yeah. We're getting coming up to a break, but I want to bring some listener comments in. Jim asks, what role did gay people taking refuge in large, more accepting cities have in gentrification?
Yes, gay people definitely played a big role in this. They, without children, especially at the very beginning, before gay couples started to form and have children and the big push for adoption, et cetera, they often had a lot of wealth that they could spend, and they also had a certain freedom in not having to restrict their choice of residences to places right near good schools. And so that gave them sort of a freewheeling view of really attractive neighborhoods to settle in.
Well, and I'm guessing there's also a fair amount of overlap between, you know, LGBT folks and artists who were also some of the early pioneers.
That too. Both of them have, I think you could safely say, tight-knit communities, good whisper networks, as it were, pre-social networks, right, where they talk to each other, say, come explore this neighborhood. You'll really like it. It's really nicely located. There are good deals here, et cetera, et cetera.
We're coming up, as I said, on a break, but you're in New York City. What, you know, now Michael Bloomberg is running for president. What role did he have as mayor as all this was happening in New York City?
Mike Bloomberg has an interesting legacy here. In some ways, he did amazing things in terms of creating affordable housing, the huge number of 165,000 units of affordable housing. But he was less interested really in preserving communities as they were. He thought that the way to prevent gentrification was to make the schools bad and let crime go up. And that, I think, with hindsight, even at the time, I think struck many people in the community organizations as overly simplistic. I think people who are in the trenches doing this type of work hope that they can really have safe communities where people are not being pushed out by high rents.
All right. That is Matthew Sherman. He is the author of Newcomers, Gentrification, and Its Discontents. We're going to continue our conversation with him for the rest of the hour, and we'd love to hear from you. Tell us how gentrification has affected your life or your neighborhood. How have you been displaced by it, or maybe you've played a role in gentrifying a neighborhood? Tell us about that as well. It's 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Or you can get in touch on Twitter or Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny, who I believe returns tomorrow. We're talking with Matthew Sherman. He's the author of Newcomers, Gentrification, and Its Discontents. And we would love to hear from you. Again, the number 866-733-6786. And let's go to the phones. Joe in Oakland, you're first. Welcome.
Well, thank you. It's an interesting thing when you talk about gentrification, but if you take an area that's very lacking in housing, as we know the Bay Area is, and you go in and take and convert buildings that were not residential. For instance, I was involved in five different projects in the Oakland-Emeryville area, one of which we took the old Sears building on Telegraph in Oakland and made it lofts, and Jerry Brown was one of our biggest tenants. We then took an old bakery in Emeryville and converted it into lofts. And then we took an old electric light bulb factory where we got historic tax credits, where it was the first place where women worked en masse in Oakland, actually in California, made 93 lofts and rented them out in 6 weeks, which was unheard of, in an area of Oakland that nobody would want to go to at night, West Oakland. Now we've just completed a brand new 120 units down by the Bay Bridge, again in an area in Oakland that was not having as much housing as it needed. So what my point here is that investors who are willing to step up to the plate to go into areas that are in very questionable socioeconomic and even dangerous to a manner of speaking and take those areas, it often can be the initiator for the neighborhood to change for the positive.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is that people who are willing to take these risks and put up their money that may be blamed for the beginning of gentrification have gone out and risked their money to put housing out there that wasn't there before.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And Matthew Sherman, speak to that. And not only the risk-taking, but, you know, the making neighborhoods more safe, bringing more services to the neighborhoods. I mean, I think the point that he's making, and maybe you make in the book, is that, you know, gentrification is, it's more nuanced than just like black and white, good and bad.
Right. I do make a point of saying that gentrification is neither good nor bad. It's really a result of this macroeconomic change that I mentioned before, making from the manufacturing economy to a creative professional one. And so your caller, by converting industrial areas and trying to address the housing shortage in that way, you know, that does make a lot of sense. That's sort of what happened in Soho and Dumbo and other areas. Some people say that's not really gentrification, because there were no residences there before. It was companies, and that's sort of true.
But it contributes to gentrification.
I'm sorry?
But it contributes to gentrification.
It contributes. It's sort of like part of the picture, and talking about it would have been a big hole, I guess, as it were. So, you know, I think that the question of turning neighborhoods around, or, you know, socioeconomic desirability, I think you sort of have to be careful about that. I'm not exactly familiar with the neighborhoods your caller is talking about, but a lot of times neighborhoods exist where outsiders don't necessarily think they exist. That's one thing. And then another thing is, as you said at the outset, or I think it was the clip of me saying it, but which is, let's see if what you're trying to do is to improve a neighborhood, what is neighborhood but the people in it? So let's make sure that there is some benefit that accrues to the people who are there. Now, if there are no one is there, I guess then you've answered that question. If it's industrial businesses that were there before, then maybe there are ways to keep those industrial businesses in place, good jobs, let's say. But I don't mean to paint gentrification as a good versus bad issue. At this point, it's with us to stay.
And Joe, before I let you go, let me just ask you, are you saying, sort of reading in between the lines there, that you feel like maybe you've been vilified, when in fact you feel like you've taken a risk, a financial risk, gone into these places and made them better?
Well, remember, down by the old Oakland train station, you know where I'm talking about, down by the Oakland train station in a neighborhood where they were small businesses, and they have moved out for one reason or another, you actually have a neighborhood that's in decline. Because whenever you have empty anything, then you have people illegally moving in, fires get set, dumping goes on. And, of course, we have a problem with that in Oakland. So if you take a neighborhood that some houses are there, but because you bring in the housing that's so badly needed and a certain element in our community wants to scream, oh, you're gentrifying the area. Well, yeah, that's how it got started in the first place. Everybody's concerned about NIMBY, but they got their house because somebody built it in a neighborhood that wasn't built on in the first place.
And Joe, let me just ask you, was any of the housing you built affordable housing or subsidized housing, or was it all market rate?
It was market rate, but now, as you well know, everything now that's being built has to have a certain percentage of it be lower cost housing.
Yeah.
Well, so let's just take the newest building down by the Bay Bridge. A certain percentage of that has to be rented out at a lower number than the normal market rent.
Well,
which is well and good.
Yeah. Well, and that's a big issue. And let me let our guest weigh in on this, because Matthew, there is this debate about whether we should just build all kinds of housing because there's a shortage, and even if it's market rate, it's going to relieve some of the pressure off of, you know, less expensive housing, where maybe people are getting displaced because there isn't enough other housing. I mean, what are your thoughts about that? You know, can you, if you just let the market be unfettered or less fettered and allow more housing, encourage more housing, whether it's market rate or not, is that going to help the lack of affordability in a neighborhood or a city?
Yeah, it's a good question. There's definitely a tension between affordability and gentrification. You know, Mike Bloomberg, as I said before, he was really into creating affordable housing. He was less concerned about displacing people. The best way to, let's say, increase the supply of housing is to tear down a 3-story building and with apartments in it and build a 10-story building in its place. And suddenly you have, three times as much housing. But there are a couple things that happen. When you build that 10-story building, chances are it will come in at the high end. And that's just sort of a natural impulse by developers to get the highest price possible where the profit margins are the highest, right? Unless you have some sort of requirement that part of the housing be set aside for affordable housing. So that's one thing that happens. So in that sense, actually flooding a neighborhood with a lot of housing supply doesn't necessarily bring down prices. There was an interesting study by the displacement project at the urban displacement project at Berkeley, actually, that looked at the Mission and said the building boom in the 1990s didn't do anything to relieve prices in the short term, although eventually, after about a decade or so, that supply did filter through.
Part of that was probably the dot-com bust, though, I would
that,
think.
That as well, yes. But it's not necessarily an either-or thing. For one thing that I really look at a lot is how a lot of times the impulse to build is to build in low-income neighborhoods, because those are the neighborhoods nowadays that are closest to transit, right? And those are the neighborhoods nowadays that are most attractive to people, in part because they're close to transit, in part because they're edgy, et cetera. So is it really fair to those low-income neighborhoods to put the onus or the burden of extra housing supply, of fixing our affordability problem, on those low-income neighborhoods exclusively? Or is there a way to be more equitable in the way that you distribute density around a different area?
Yeah, and in that regard, Liz writes, often gentrifiers are villainized and pitted against those they are supposedly displacing. To me, the real issue is income inequality and institutional racism. And Matthew, talk about the role that banks play in all of this.
Good question, sure. Throughout the middle part of the century, banks didn't really give loans to people in low-income neighborhoods, in communities with large numbers of blacks and Latinos. They were considered risks, right? High-risk loans. That's how they justified it. But what that created was basically neighborhoods where very few people owned their own homes because they could not get loans to buy them.
Redlining.
Redlining, exactly. And then I should also say that that when these minorities, when these people of color tried to get housing in places where they could get loans, let's say white neighborhoods, they often found themselves steered away from them by real estate agents, maybe kept out of them by covenants of some sort. Or, you know, there are cases when they did succeed in buying a home in a white neighborhood and getting a loan, and then people would protest and throw rocks through their window. So it's not a great position to be in there. So these tend to be the places that have been disinvested in over time. One of the stories that I tell in the book is how one of the so-called pioneers in Brooklyn, his name was Everett Ortner, he actually enlisted. He had a very hard time getting a loan for his brownstone. It wasn't technically redlined, but it was definitely considered high risk. He went through 12 banks before the 13th one gave him a loan. And after he moved in, he discovered that there were a lot of these white professionals moving into Park Slope, and he convinced Chase Bank to invest $100 million in mortgages in urban neighborhoods. And banks, you know, found gentrification to be a great deal for them. Yeah. These were low-priced homes, and they gave their money to these so-called pioneers, and they were able to make money off interest for these loans.
Ian tweets, how much overlap is there between gentrifiers and home flippers?
I'm sorry, gentrifiers and?
People who buy and sell homes, home flippers.
Oh, home flippers. Well, that's a good question. You do hear occasional stories about home flippers, absolutely. It depends what you mean by that. If you mean people who actually go in and renovate homes and then resell them after renovating them.
Yeah, and evict whoever was living there.
Yeah. That certainly happens. I can't say that it's a predominant number of cases that I have seen, but it certainly plays a role.
Yeah. And you write, I think, a little bit about the Ellis Act here in California, which does allow owners to evict people and renovate the homes. They have to take it off the market for a certain period of time after they rent it. But, you know, that certainly has played a role in people being displaced.
That's right. And you mentioned Rene Yanez before. He was threatened with the Ellis Act, which basically, you know, his landlord had bought his place in the late 90s, right around 2000, and wasn't making very much money off of it, 13 years later, even though real estate prices in the Mission were going up so much. And so he invoked the Ellis Act, said, I'm going out of business as a real estate person, and you have to leave. That is a loophole that that a lot of people use throughout, like right around the it was, I think, around the 2005, 2007, and then again after the Great Recession as well. Since then, San Francisco has tightened the rules around the Ellis Act, made it more expensive for landlords to evict people through it and to use it. And so in that way, it is less of a threat of displacement than it once was.
All right, let's go to the phones. And Suzanne in Oakland, welcome.
Hi, I am so glad that he at least said what he said about old school redlining and everything else, because these neighborhoods that are downtrodden became these neighborhoods exactly for what he said. Banks wouldn't lend to these people. The small mom and pops went out. It was just a continuation. And now gentrification is like, okay, well, we can put in a blurb and a line, and yes, this happened. I'm glad he put it in the book and people read it. And those whites who are not all white will read it and just like, oh, yeah, okay, well, so what? Humanity is out of the whole equation because these people have been there, have been working, have been supporting their families. They are not bad people, but they have been given the extreme same old raw frickin' deal that is systematically in the whole scope of everything. And now, before my blood pressure goes up, I guess I need to listen off the air. But what were you going to say?
No. Go finish your thought. I was going to ask Matthew to respond to what you were saying.
Oh, that's pretty much my thought.
Okay.
Right now.
All right. Great. Well, yeah, Suzanne, thank you so much. Matthew, what are your thoughts about that? I mean, she's basically acknowledging what you did say, but maybe suggesting it's a bigger part of the problem than you've written about, or you know, we've talked about at least in this hour.
Yeah, I mean, I think she has a good point. What more can I add? This is this really set the stage for a lot of gentrification that happened afterwards. It really raises the question, I think, of equity, which is a big theme of my book. It goes to the heart of, let's say, a neighborhood does become popular. Where does that influx of money go? Does it go to the people who lived there before? Does it even go to the city treasury to, let's say, create affordable housing for the people who are being pushed out? And that's an interesting aspect as well. Both New York and San Francisco have tax caps, which limit how much the property taxes on a property can increase under a single owner. And that's meant to protect, let's see, people from unfair tax hikes. But it also means that a house can get so much more valuable, and yet the public doesn't really seem much benefit from it in terms of increased tax revenues.
There's a comment from Dave who writes, instead of gentrification, why not call it progress? And Roberto writes, it's so painful as a Mission District native to talk about gentrification. I'll never again be able to afford to live or buy there. But I'm still there every day and still contribute to its culture. And Matthew, I mean, certainly renters have taken the brunt of a lot of this displacement. But, you know, in some places, including the Mission, longtime residents actually own their homes. And that's true in the Bayview, Hunters Point as well, which is also seeing not only a lot of housing being built, but, I think longtime homeowners leaving the Bay Area, selling their home, cashing out, so to speak. So, you know, there is some of that goes on as well.
Yes. Now, let's hope that people who own their homes get a good price for their homes when they sell and they're able to go someplace nice.
But that's sort of, in a way, part of the problem, right? I mean, because then it makes it less – I mean, fewer people can afford to pay those prices. I mean, that's the market, right?
Yes, right. Well, people who have owned homes for a long time bought at a good price. I think that I would put them on the benefiting side of the gentrification equation. And this is why, which is when you sell your house, you'll be able to reap that profit. Now, you do face some obstacles. With Proposition 13, you shouldn't be facing huge property tax increases. Other parts of the country, you do, although there are ways to combat that. You do see a changed neighborhood, and there certainly is a great loss of identity that I think goes with that when you see everybody, all of your friends and such move out and you're all alone. That's definitely on the negative side. But hopefully you should, from an economic standpoint, you own your home for a long time. The value of it increases. When you sell it, you'll be able to reap that. Unless you're swindled, which often does happen, you should be able to reap that profit and take that money with you.
Yeah, and in some cases, I think people are approached by buyers, who weren't even intending to leave or sell necessarily. And so I think you may get a good price, you have to be a little suspicious, too, if it's something that you weren't necessarily thinking of doing, making sure that it's really in your best interest.
Yes, and I think that might be a nice role for community-based organizations to play as they try to figure out, how do I make my community benefit from gentrification? I mean, you can fight it outright. That it was just how a lot of people in the Mission what they are doing. That is definitely one approach, but another approach would be in a high ownership neighborhood to make sure homeowners have the knowledge they need, know how much their home is worth, and make sure that when they sell, they really are getting a good deal.
All right, back to the phones now. Alan in San Francisco, welcome.
Hello. Many of the points that I wanted to talk about have been covered, but I'll say that I think that a lot of the problems with the homelessness and high prices of housing in San Francisco have to do with most of the financial incentives to build, buy, and sell housing in San Francisco simply has to do with the profits that are made from selling more expensive housing as opposed to less expensive housing. And that includes the city of San Francisco with its tax revenues, the banks that lend money to builders and buyers, even the people who insure and who sell, the brokers.
Well, Alan, you also bring up a implied question about rent control, because there is an incentive for landlords who own buildings to evict, find reasons to evict tenants, Matthew, because they can get market rate rent. I mean, that's part of the problem, too, isn't it?
It is. And I think in general, rent control is an important part of the equation to keeping people where they are. It's not perfect. There are a lot of problems with it. Sometimes people who can afford market rate places are taking advantage of rent control. It's also, I admit, putting a lot of onus, the burden of affordability is placed on these private landlords as opposed to on the government itself. But it's an important part. But as you mentioned, there are definitely loopholes. It's important to have legal assistance, as there is in San Francisco. There's at least some money going to help to legal clinics that can help tenants fight unfair evictions.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Again, the number is 866-733-6786. And Justin in Walnut Creek, you're next. Welcome.
Good morning. In the context of the California housing crisis, we talk about gentrification as if it is a completely racial issue, and it's totally incorrect to approach the discussion that way. The root of the issue is that cities, including San Francisco, are issuing unrestricted numbers of business licenses. And so it's not that we don't have enough houses. There's too many businesses moving into the region. And these businesses, they're not white-owned. They're all across the board. So if you want to fight gentrification, push your local city to stop bringing in so many companies. And I challenge people to do this, because when's the last time you've showed up to your local planning commission if you're so concerned about gentrification?
All right, Justin, thanks very much. And, you know, Matthew, certainly a lot of people point to tech, which sort of exploded in the Bay Area, first with the dot-com boom and then later with the Twitter tax cuts under the late mayor, Ed Lee. What are your thoughts about that? That housing is just a supply and demand thing. And the population in San Francisco has certainly grown well beyond the amount of new housing that's been built during that time.
Yeah, it's a good point that Justin brings up, and it is a thought that has been held by a number of activists in San Francisco over the years, that the real problem is not lack of supply, but rather too much demand. And so Proposition M tried to keep down the amount of new office space that could be built each year in San Francisco. And the thing about that is, it's an awfully hard mechanism to keep under control, to stop the jobs. I have a lot of sympathy for this point of view, but also from a national perspective, it's almost a miracle that San Francisco is so good at creating jobs. I guess you might say it's too good for creating jobs.
Yeah.
But even when Proposition M was in place,
we're talking about the mid-80s now, right? I mean, that's, I think, when voters passed
it
in 1986.
That's right. And the what happened was, you had Silicon Valley generating jobs, so it was not San Francisco proper. But you had tech really started in the not so much the web the dot-com boom, but after that, Facebook, Google, etc. And people nonetheless were commuting from San Francisco because they liked the quality of life. To some degree, it was because there was actually more affordable housing in San Francisco than there was in Silicon Valley, and they were commuting down there. So there was nonetheless, even though you tried to curtail the number of jobs that could be created in San Francisco, you still had a huge demand for housing.
Well, and now, and as you write about these, the Google buses, the Apple buses, these big buses taking people, techies, young folks who work in Silicon Valley, but they like living in the city. I mean, that has really become a symbol. Not so it's calmed down a little bit, but a few years ago when they were using like bus stops and not really paying for it, they were disrupting local traffic and so on. I mean, that very much became a lightning rod.
Exactly. And I try not to villainize tech people. I try not to villainize anybody in the book, because I think a lot of this problem is created by people acting in some ways out of very laudable goals. The developer who was on earlier, trying to increase housing supply, for example, the original pioneers who were young marrieds who moved back to Brooklyn because they thought they wanted to save the city, that sort of thing. So, I mean, tech jobs, for example, that have a very low injury rate. These are, you know, well-paying jobs. These are
clean industries generally.
Yeah, the envy of what I think a lot of economic development directors around the country would want for their own hometown.
Here's another comment from a listener who writes, I'm a black professional who bought in South Berkeley in 2005 when it was still a heavily black neighborhood. I didn't see myself as a gentrifier until a white friend told me that I was. I've definitely benefited from the increased property values over the years, but the loss of numbers of members of the black community has been a negative one for me. And Matthew, obviously there's many sides to this question, some good, some not so good.
Absolutely. It shows to what extent place matters and you really identify with your neighborhood, and it's very hard to see a change.
Well, we've just about a minute left, but looking ahead, what have you learned from the book that you think maybe communities who are trying to resist the tide or control the tide of gentrification or at least its negative effects, what should they learn?
Well, I do see, of course, a renewed interest in rent control around the country, and that can be, it can be a very promising mechanism, as I mentioned before. And so we'll probably see some of that continuing. You certainly see some very very virulent anti-gentrification groups sprout up around the country, and I'm not entirely sure whether that will be successful or not in achieving their aims, but that's certainly going that way. And then on the other hand, you have a lot of anti-gentrification sentiment as well. I see a lot of people focusing in California especially on increasing the housing supply.
Yeah, and that's going to be a discussion certainly continuing, especially as the legislature reconvenes in January. We are out of time, but Matthew Sherman, thank you so much for joining us. He's the author of Newcomers, Gentrification, and Its Discontents, also senior editor at WNYC Public Radio in New York. And he's going to be in the Bay Area later in the week at Alley Cat Books in San Francisco on Friday at 7 o'clock in the evening, and at Oakland Public Library on Saturday, December 7th at 1 o'clock. Matthew, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Scott, for having me.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, Ariana Prale, Susan Britton, and Caroline Smith. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny, who I believe returns on Tuesday. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.